This is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. Actually, this morning I am not at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. I am here with Priscilla Bowen at her home, and it is April 23rd, 2015. And Priscilla, thank you so much for having me here in your house and welcoming me here.
Well, Heather, you are welcome. I've known you for a while, and I've been looking forward to spending time with you. Also, I want to thank you and the Birchfield Penny for inviting me. The questions you provided ahead of time really got my thinking going in a really rewarding direction. I've spent several days thinking about my life and why I do stuff. It's really just a great process. Mm-hmm. So thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, I think we're very grateful all around. So a little backstory. Priscilla is one of our best volunteers in addition to being a fantastic artist here in Western New York. And whether it is installing the Artists Among Us or any various shows, or Priscilla has also taken care of making sure that Charles Birchfield's studio looks like he left the studio earlier that day. And she is one of the few people who gets to cross that fourth wall and walk into Birchfield's studio to care for it for us. And we have just been so grateful for all of her love and attentions on us.
Well, I knew Heather would be fun as an interviewer because she's already got me off script here. I've got my notes. But that is one of the most rewarding parts of my life. And one of the things I love about Buffalo, Western New York, and the Birchfield Penny Art Gallery is this pretty unique ability to feel like you're truly part of an artistic community. We all do it in different ways. There are other artists who are making more professional progress, but I'm very comfortable just floating around, showing work, sometimes selling it. Occasionally I'll win a prize or get some kind of stipend, but volunteering at the Birchfield Penny has just been great. You get to know more of the community, and the community doesn't have sharp lines. The staff may be staff, but many of them are artists as well. Yeah. Many of them are friends that I run into other places. It's a community, and back to being in Birchfield's studio, that is such an honor because from the time I was 16 and discovered Charles Birchfield, I was taken by his, at that time for me, approach that I couldn't verbalize, but I've come to see, whether it was industry, whether it was nature, he connected with the spiritual. And to be in his studio, I'm getting prickles on the back of my neck right now, and every time I go to Dustin there, it's the same, but it's also comfortable. I've even been bold enough to think to myself, oh, good morning, Chucky, I'm in your studio again. And, you know, to dust off his jacket or his easel, it's just a stunning honor. And yet it's so down to earth. His studio was really pretty darn simple. Mm-hmm. Not a big fancy place. Mm-hmm. I've been in the building out in Gardenville, because I knew somebody who was renting an apartment out there. It's been my honor and pleasure to have gotten to know Catherine Parker. And the connections, it's just like a beautiful, glistening spider web. So, volunteering, yes, at the Birchfield Penny has been a treasure to me. Got to know Dwayne Hatchett that way when we did his show. Was in his studio dusting his stuff off. And that was a hoot because, you know, I'm going, so Dwayne, what should I clean this off with? And artists are so casual, or can be, about their own work. And, you know, he handed me some tools from his kitchen, you know, some brushes and, you know, clean inside with this. So it's just been rewarding to volunteer with the Birchfield Penny. You're such a youngster, Heather, because when I was there in the 50s, man, there were like only, what, a third of the buildings that are there now. Well, now you're bringing me to think of how, and again, it may not be unique in our country or in the world, but it certainly is not common the way the wider community hooks into Buff State and the Birchfield Penny. UB is a great place in its own way, but it doesn't have that community feeling. You look at the recent presidents, the current president of Buff State, the last one, and others before, they really had a concern about connecting with Buffalo and in a more blue-collar way. And I come from blue-collar background. I mean, my daddy worked in a factory his whole life out in the town of Wheatfield. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. We didn't have a lot of money, but I didn't realize that till I got all grown up. But I'm comfortable wearing that blue collar. And I'm comfortable at Birchfield Penny and Buff State because they're comfortable with that. When I began to volunteer there, they first asked me about being a docent, which I could have applied for at the Albright. And I said, no, I'm only going to do stuff where I can wear my jeans. I've had my lifetime of being a teacher and being a professional and a graphic designer. So, again, the Birchfield has just been perfect for me. Mm. It's a blue-collar place where I can fit right in and say what I want, and nobody minds.
And nobody cares, you know, and we all want to see you for who you really are. Do you remember at openings at the old space at Rockwell Hall when Victor and Don used to make, like, kielbasa and, like...
Oh, gosh, yes.
Oh, my God, the food at the openings used to be amazing. And then, of course, and I think this is very much why I respond to the Birchfield, too, is because we do it our own way, you know? And so eventually we had to stop. Vic had to stop making Don had to stop making kielbasa and all that sort of thing. Because the health department was like, nope, sorry, you know, you don't have...
Oh, yeah.
But the way we do it, it's like, what do you have to give? Whatever it is you want to give, that's what we want to have, you know? And we want to create a space for you to give what you want to give rather than us asking for something that might not be your interest. And I think that's led to situations both with staff as well where, you know, I'm already being pulled into doing curation and that sort of thing. And so people are starting to say, okay, what do you have to give? What's your interest? And so I recently curated this show of ceramic sculptures from a new collection, 200 pieces that's been donated to the museum. And so I selected all nude ceramic sculptures, kind of like trying to get a sense of like classical roots of figurative sculpture and stuff like that, but from a very postmodern, post-postmodern perspective. I was supported, I kind of wanted to take more like a queer bent to it and that sort of thing, and looking at the distinction between gender and biological sex, and how oftentimes biological sex and gender are confused, you know, and especially in a show of nude sculptures, a lot of people are going to say he, she, based on the genitalia, you know? And so I was supported by Scott, by Tony, in saying, actually, I want to put up a text panel about trying to look at these pieces outside of gender. And they're like, all right.
Heather, that's been my experience as a volunteer, that all those folks you mentioned, whether it's Scott or Tullis or whoever I'm working with, it's just easygoing, open to listening. And I'm just realizing, as I sit here in my home, how organically this glistening spider web goes out into the community, because it was my good fortune to have Ted Piatchuk and Marlene Longdon move in across the street years ago. So I simply became friends with them as neighbors, great people. And then, lo and behold, Ted and I have a lot in common because of the art.
Yeah.
And so I not only got to see that amazing building come to be, but kind of from the inside out, because Ted and I would be out raking leaves, and I'd say, so, you know, what's happening? And I'd get a little off-the-cuff update about the struggles and the explorations, all the trips Ted took to look at museums all over the place. So it's just so wonderfully connected to the community. There's not a line between the institution and the community.
Yeah, I think that, and there's not a line between the artists and the arts community. I think a big part, too, is that, and this is true with Albright as well, you know, Jody Hansen used to be a preparator there, but especially the Birchfield, I see artists in the role of staff. You know, I see Patrick Robidoux and Tom Holt and Don Metz, you know, and Tullis as well, you know, all these people who are active artists and able to both have their personal practice and bring a larger consciousness to the community. And I think that's a very big part of what we do. And Tony. Tony's an artist, you know? Tony, I mean...
Well, decades ago, Tony was my neighbor just a few houses away.
Oh, really?
And so I knew Brendan Bannon, one of the artists I admire most. It's my pleasure and honor to still know Brendan. I don't see him often. He's very busy these days. But I knew him when he was a little kid annoying my dog. And I love to remind him of that story. But what an amazing guy. And then in later years, I'd be out working in my flower bed And he'd come by and talk to me, and he was caring for his mother, who had serious mm-hmm. health problems. Mm-hmm. And we'd talk, and I'm going, wow, Brendan is amazing. So no surprise to me that he can go out into our world and connect with humanity and bring us back images that hopefully will help us all to care more about our fellow humans. So yeah, the connections go on and on.
So your ties into, you know, the Western New York arts community extend in so many different ways. You know, they're personal, they're professional, they're caring, they're, you know. That's what I love about the Western New York art scene is that mm-hmm. it's never just professional. You know, even if you're meeting somebody, for me, as I've been doing these interviews, you know, there's many artists that I've met that I have no personal connection with, that I only have a professional connection with. But you start talking to them for a few minutes, and pretty soon you're old mm-hmm. friends, you know, pretty soon you're like, oh, you know that person, I know that person, yeah. Did you see this show, you know, what were you doing October 12th, 2006, you know, how did, all these things that, there's influences that affect all of our lives differently, and I have to say that's what I love about this Living Legacy project, because it's one thing to have the archives of artists who are no longer with us, but I think it's a much more powerful thing to say, actually, we have opportunities due to our deep relationships to have conversations now while the artists are mm-hmm, young mm-hmm. and producing and at various points in their careers. And isn't that incredible that it's not like, you know, it's not these disconnected artists flung across the world. And though granted many Western New York artists are outside of the region now, that really they're, everyone's here and we have these opportunities now. One thing I love with Esther, for example, Esther's one of the first artists I interviewed, you know, she's young, she's my age. We're going to interview her again in like 5 years and uh-huh, see what's uh-huh. changed in her career and her conception of her art production in those years, you know, and we can do that every 5 to 7 years. It's kind of like the Milton Rogovin aspect of this
great
project.
Idea, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Milton, another person, Milton and Anne, that I got to know through Wegmans, admittedly, but then later on, you know, attending some presentations that Milton would make at the Birchfield Penny, you know, when his work was on exhibit there. But I'm also thinking of the changes that Heather just referred to. Not too many years ago, John and Lazara Nelson lived right next door here. Mm-hmm. So my husband and I made friends with them. Well, you know, they have since moved out to Amherst, but they began Pausa Art House. It was my honor to be the inaugural show there, and they struggled, you know, who was going to come, and, you know, not that many people in the first months out-of-the-way place. Now look at Pausa Art House. It gets reviewed by the music critic, by the art critics. It's such a wonderful combination of visual art and music. I think just last week, the musicians came and played off the wall, so to speak, played music that was inspired by the current paintings mm-hmm. that are on the wall. So these changes are, again, an organic part of the whole process.
And then I also look at Pausa and think about how it's in a space that used to be Sugar City, which was this young, energetic, you know, kind of alternative art space, which is now growing up a little bit in its own way and doing incredible stuff over on Niagara Street. And then I also look at Dreamland, which in some ways is filling up the sort of, Dreamland is kind of doing what Sugar City was doing a number of years ago, being mm-hmm. like the, although I think with even more of a queer alternative bent mm-hmm. in some ways mm-hmm. of both inclusion and creating space for, like, you know, underrepresented communities mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But yeah, just that, like, we're, you know, we can sustain these different things in different yeah. ways. Just because Sugar City lost their space there doesn't mean that they can't find it somewhere else. And
that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, look at us. We've been talking for 20 minutes and we haven't even hit on any of the questions. But what's lovely about this is, in some ways, you know, like I said earlier, these questions are very boilerplate. But what I find really spectacular about these interviews is, like, the conversation we just had. Is how it can just be whatever we want it to be. So
true, Heather, because I realize that some of the things I thought about in the few days prior to this, we've already covered.
Yeah.
But let's go to your boilerplates, which were really good questions.
Okay.
Got me thinking in good directions. You pick one.
All right. Well, Priscilla, what inspired you to want to be an artist or want to pursue a career in the arts or to make that part of your life?
Great question. First of all, it just comes with the territory. I can always remember drawing. I mean, there was never a time when I didn't think in a curious way that I was an artist. I didn't consciously, you know, think as a little kid I was an artist, but I was always drawing. So for me, what worked is to follow paths that spoke to me. And then I found throughout my life, others appeared on that path that encouraged me or inspired me or both. And it's funny how things fit in. I had an aunt next door. And I wasn't super close to her, but she seemed to enjoy me coming over when I was a little kid. Now, she wasn't interested in the drawings I did. She liked the fact that I liked words, and I still do. Sometimes I even use a few words in my visual artwork. I like that poetry can come in so many forms. It can come as images. It can come as words. But when I thought back on it, this is just 3 days ago, the fact that this aunt would say, oh, come on over, Priscilla, talk to me. She would tell me, you know so many big words. And I think that encouraged me to always stay interested in words and what they can build and construct and elicit. So there's stuff as simple as that, but she also had, and I didn't think of this till a few days ago, some beautiful china painting in her house. It wasn't hers. It was her aunt's, which would have been my great aunt. But it was gorgeous. I can still picture it exactly. And I think that was the first good art I saw, was a tall white porcelain pitcher, probably 14 inches tall, with bunches of grapes and grape leaves on it. Beautifully painted. Beautifully painted. I've seen china paintings since, and I know this stuff was good. So there's the little beginning seeds. Then, back when I was a little kid growing up in Wheatfield, it was pretty rural, there were no central schools.
Mm-hmm.
So we got bussed into Niagara Falls to go to high school. And then stuff really started happening. I could take art courses. Didn't really have art in my little two-room country school that I went to, but I could take art courses. And I had a wonderful teacher, Dolores Amatuzio, who encouraged me, said, no, you're good. And she gave me my first chance to paint with oil paints. And I still have that painting. And she, I think, first put the seed in my head that maybe I should go to college, which girls from my little rural area didn't do. A few of the boys went to college and inevitably became ministers. it was a little Lutheran settlement. And the year I went to college, only one girl had gone to college before. And the year I went, me and my friend Kathy, two of us went. So I never even thought it was on my radar. So it was that ninth grade art teacher who planted the seed. And then, this is a great story. I was in 12th grade, my senior year in Niagara Falls High School. There was a teacher named Jeanette Wiley, and she was a social studies teacher. I didn't have her for class, but she was the advisor to the National Honor Society, of which I was a member. And so my senior year, she was organizing a presentation for the whole school. We were going to have an assembly, and it had to do with what you do after high school. And so one of our Honor Society members was going to pose as a student who was going to join the military. And another was going to pose as someone who was going to go work in some business. And then she asked if I would pose as someone going to college. And I said, I'm not going to college. And she said, well, just do it. You can do this. She said, I'll help you. We're going to go up to Buff State. I'll drive you up, and you can talk with the admissions officer. When I look back on it, she was really, I'm practically getting misty-eyed thinking of it. thinking, here's a student that should go. I wonder how I can kind of finagle this.
Uh-huh.
She brought me up. We talked to the admissions officer. My guess is they even colluded ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
He said, fill out the admissions form. I said, but I'm not coming to college. He said, just fill it out. And then, because he was going to be the one who was talking to me uh-huh. on stage at Niagara Falls High School. So I did, and one thing led to another, and I started thinking about it, started talking to my parents, and pretty soon, bingo, I was accepted at Buff State, practically before I even decided I wanted to go to college. So my only regret is, and I'm kind of grateful that I can at least put it in the archives of the Birchfield Penny, thank you, Jeanette Wiley. I never came back to say thank you, and that was a huge, huge what? That's a blank space in my life. I should have gone back to say thank you. Because from there, it just blossomed. Buff State, to me, it was a golden age. I had what I think were some of the most amazing professors back then.
Who are some of your professors?
Well, Joe Belinsky, sculptor professor, was one of the main ones who inspired me. I just loved Joe, and he seemed to enjoy me. Ended up going to his house sometimes, meeting his wonderful wife, Ruth. But Joe, and I'll never forget this, constantly was using the word meaningful. Well, is what you're doing meaningful there? Let's look at this work. Is it meaningful? And we used to sort of joke about it, but that meant a lot. Joe was always looking for the meaningful in stuff. So I took as many courses as I could with him. Did I become a sculptor? No. But he was inspirational. Total spectrum of people. Another fellow named Wally Green. He was scary, but we loved him. We used to hang out and have coffee with him in the coffee room in the basement of Rockwell Hall, which is long gone. He would pin you down, put you on the spot, but it was so good for you. A guy I never had a class with, George O'Connell, but he was a wonderful artist, a printmaker, and nice guy. And again, you could hang out and talk with him. You didn't just go to class and then leave, but we got to know these people, and they were all practicing artists. Dwayne Anderson, who's still in the community, was my ceramics instructor, wonderful woman, young, quiet woman at the time, but again, always opening doors and windows. I remember we were supposed to do a project on the wheel, and I couldn't get it, man, for the life of me. And so she said, you know what, you can do a built project. So I ended up doing a chess set based on Alice in Wonderland, which Ooh. I still have. Dwayne, Bunny Anderson, said, great, you know. I mean, just always this encouragement mm-hmm. and allowing you to go in a direction that was suitable to you. Mm-hmm. Trying to think who else. Oh, guy, a painter named Morton Grossman, mm-hmm. inspiring. His work was hanging recently in a show at the Birchfield Penny. And I'm going, oh, Mort, I remember your work now. Yeah. Anyway, again, inspiring. He took us over to the Darwin Martin House, which was falling into a pile of rubble back then, and told us with concern and distress, you know, this was a terrible thing to be happening. So all these people who cared about stuff, again, going back to Joe, what's meaningful? So I felt lucky to be there at the time. And then when I came back years later for my master's, happened upon a guy who changed my life again, Bill Helwig, mm-hmm. who's passed away now, but was a nationally known enamels artist, not jewelry, but wall pieces. And I was working on my master's. It was in art education, but I was trying to take studio courses. And I considered drawing because by then I found I was always coming back to drawing. The work of the person teaching drawing then just didn't connect with me. And I had seen Bill Helwig's enameling in a local shop, Arlene Todorov's shop on Bryant and Ashland, I think. And I went, oh my God, this is art. And this guy can draw and paint. So I signed up and took every course I could with Bill. Ended up taking a master's project with him for 3 credits, as opposed to getting 6 credits for a written paper, which didn't attract me at all. So for a while, I was an enamelist. I ended up having 3 residencies at Art Park, 3 summers in a row, back in the golden age of Art Park.
What years were you at Art Park?
It was the mid-70s. I guess I'd have to look that up, Heather. I'm not very good at the numbers. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just things kept... I guess what I believe is you have to look for the path that suits you, but then learn to recognize. And we don't always. Sometimes we let things walk by us that we should have hooked up with and didn't, or vice versa, you know, wasted our time on something. I haven't done it perfectly, but for the most part, followed my path. And for me, staying here in Western New York, in Buffalo, and staying closely connected to the Birchfield Penny has been major for me. One of my closest personal friends, did I meet him there? Gary Wolf. I know we worked on the Dwayne Hatchett show together. I'll have to talk to him and see.
But the two of you are staples at the Birchfield. Between you and Gary, between, you know, all the work that you guys do to help, it's like when there's a big show coming up, and like with Levy, you know, Gary, we hung 140 works in a week. Oh, it was insane, and I don't know if we could have done it without Gary, you know?
Gary's amazing, yeah. Yeah, I wish I could be volunteering more there now, but I'm working on a few health issues, but hopefully I'll get back over there to have fun with you folks.
You take care of you, but we're waiting. We're just waiting with bated breath.
That's good.
I feel that you touched on the next question I generally ask as well, which is where did you go to school and those situations, as well as some of your major influences. But would you like to talk about any other artists who influenced you in your work throughout the years?
That was fun to think about, too. And I've thought about that before. Interestingly, Charles Birchfield was and is so central to me. And this has nothing to do with the fact that you guys happen to be interviewing me. It's interesting because my work doesn't really look like his, but the essence that he finds the spiritual, not only in nature, which is my main subject matter, but he found the humanity in simple houses and hands-on industry. Our industry now is getting so much more mechanized, and robots do so much. But like I say, my dad worked his life in a factory, came home with split fingers in winter from his hands being worked so hard, which is unhappily and happily something I inherited. Mine split open from using art materials and washing my hands in winter too, but it makes me connected to my dad. But Birchfield had that blue-collar attitude.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fancy dude. So he's been a big influence to me, including his journals, reading the wonderful things that he had the clear eyes to see. And I think a lot of his life was like my childhood and origins. Just a lot I can connect with.
Yeah.
But beyond that, always nature and the organic. So people like Henry Moore, George O'Keefe, mm-hmm. Turner, Asian art often connects with me, Native American art. Somehow the connection to the whole, the all, the earth, Gauguin. But then there's a whole aspect of humanity that even though I never draw or paint people, mean so much to me. People like Leonard Baskin, Kathy Kollwitz, Rembrandt, Aikens, Durier, an interesting combination where you have both human imagery and one of my favorite all-time pieces is his piece of earth, piece of ground. And I, a few years ago, did my own interpretation of that, which was purchased by someone on the Birchfield Penny staff, Mary and her wonderful husband, Tom. Again, as you can hear in this, I'm big on connections. They mean a lot to me.
Yeah, too.
But contemporary people, well, any expressionists, and my work looks nothing like them. I do what people term realistic work, whether they're seashells or planets or leaves, but they do inevitably open up into Zen space. Mm-hmm. So the expressionists, I love because they open up. I love, Franz Kline and de Kooning, Jackson Pollock. When I was a freshman in college, I used to go over and sit on the floor for hours in front of Convergence. But then my fave, beautiful Zen blocks of color. Help me out, Heather.
Rothko?
Thank you, Mark Rothko. Isn't it wonderful? We can still do artwork, but we can't remember names when we get older.
Names don't tell you enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Rothko's pieces are amazing. And then finally, not at all like my work, but so important to me, Andy Goldsworthy. There's someone who has totally connected to nature, immersed himself in it, and is using the very essence of the earth to make constructions that for a moment or sometimes longer take us beyond the boundaries of ourself. So yeah, those are folks who mean a lot to me. There's tons more. The art world is such a treasure chest.
And especially with you, Priscilla, one of the things that I've noticed in you over our time knowing each other is your curiosity and your energy. And I get the feeling that you could be anywhere and find something to say, wow, you know, stop and look at that. And I see that in you a lot. I see your, just this positivity and this inquisitiveness that I think comes out wherever you are.
Heather, that's really great. I think that's very perceptive of you. And I don't mean it in the sense that I am delighted that it is a compliment, but I think the world would be better off if all of us would look out a little more, look outward, and notice what's happening in every present moment.
And question.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see, and this is something I see in Charlie too. You're not afraid to question, and from Charlie, how I see it is he wasn't afraid to question himself.
Yeah.
You know, even when it's hard for him, and even when he in some ways was berating himself for not pushing himself hard enough or becoming comfortable or these things, he always came through it, you know, to a place of finding the beauty again. But he wasn't afraid to question himself. And I see that as going hand in hand with curiosity and an inquisitiveness, if you will.
Yeah, I admire that profoundly about him. But I also have come to see he's a much more serious guy than me. Yeah, I'm...
He might be a little bit more like your husband was.
Yeah. Some interior thinking. Mm-hmm. But that's fine. We all need to decide, or not decide, what? Recognize what we are. There are people who are more serious than me who get farther along in the art world. But I, again, thanks to this process, realize how content I am. Mm-hmm. I don't always follow up on stuff. I don't always think, oh, I ought to apply for that and that, and I'll build more of a reputation. I'm comfortable that things have happened the way they have. I do enter juried shows regularly, and I get invited to the galleries I really value around here, whether it's Indigo or Studio Heart, the Keenan Center, Carnegie. Local curators have been kind enough to approach me. So the work has been out there, and then people see it and do just what Heather and I are talking about. Stop in that present moment and go, wow, there's something about this that strikes me. And then they decide they'd like to live with it, and they buy it. And that's such an honor. So I can sit here now in my home with Heather, and I can picture my work right across the street this way, in my friend's house there, down the street, another house, across the street at Ted and Marlene's. I can start spotting it all over. One piece in the Birchfield Penny Collection, three pieces at Children's Hospital, work at Roswell Park. That makes me so happy and so content that something about me is going to hang around after this part of me is gone.
It's a different type of seed.
What's it?
It's a different type of seed.
Yeah.
And I like to joke that, like I was joking earlier about not being an artist but dating them, I also, you know, my collection has grown partially through the relationships with friends that I've made. Like Esther Neeson gave me one of her early cricket pieces in trade for a sumptuous meal that I made her. You know, I just made her this absolutely over-the-top, like, marinated portobello mushrooms with goat cheese and just, like, you know, fed her well. And I love knowing that that's the relationship that we shared. But I look at all the works in my room by friends, by people I care about, by people important to me, and I see them as seeds, you know, and then other people come in and they have this different relationship with everything, and then I see how it affects them too, you know, and how they take it out.
Mm-hmm. That's great, Heather, yeah. Because when you first arrived today, I toured you around the nest, and I've got artwork by so many artists.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of them were traded, and stories go with each one. So it's like the history of my life that I get to live with day in and day out. In fact, tomorrow I have an appointment with my attorney. Years ago, she first did our will and our healthcare proxies in trade for artwork. You know?
See, that's the best. And I, you know, also living in a cooperative. I love a barter-based, you know, economy. I love that. And I think that, again, it speaks very much to what Buffalo's good at, which is building community and strengthening community.
Well, wasn't it smart of me to somehow in my life run across two friends who are masseuses? So I get a lot of massage in trade for artwork.
Oh, yeah. That is brilliant.
So, yeah. It's been good.
Priscilla, we've already touched on, you know, how your works of art get out into the community.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk a little bit more about what you create and why you create it?
Oh, good question. I really like thinking about that one, and I've thought about it before. Basically, it's a meditation process for me. It's always based in or on some reflection of nature. Again, the path, just the path where I know I belong. It chose me, but it's interesting because of its range. It's a macro-micro kind of thing. The things that appeal to me can be very tiny in nature or very large. And I'm thinking specifically of some pieces, some of my favorite, that combine those. So yes, the work is figurative, but for example, I did a still life called Moon/Plum. And there's the moon sitting on a table, and there's a plum leaning against it. And I hope that offers the opportunity for the viewer to think in a whole bunch of different directions. Another painting, one of my favorites, is Mars Orange. And it's a long horizontal, and up in the left-hand corner is the planet Mars, which is orange. In the lower right-hand corner, much larger, is an orange from our own botanical gardens here. And when you look at a real orange, not one in the supermarket, it's mottled and speckled with orange and green.
Mm-hmm.
Looks very much like the planet Mars and some of the leaves from the orange tree around it. So again, I so enjoyed spending my time immersing myself in that immense distance to Mars and the dark sky, and then something you can hold in your hand that has so much in common with that planet and so much not in common with it. Third example, two giant pea pods hanging in the darkness. One pea floating out, becoming a planet. Again, the moon. I don't know why I like the moon so much, but the moon appears in a lot of my stuff. So I don't need to question why. I enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it works for me. Other things that show up in my work a lot are roots. I love roots and the sense of what finds its way through roots out of the ground into whatever is above. An oak tree, an orange tree, an avocado tree. I like the Zen approach to eating lunch, and I'll sit and be eating my avocado and go, wow, there's California sunshine in this. So bones, I often draw bones, and I have combined them with other forms so they become landscapes. I guess I like the idea that it's good for us to connect ourselves to the greater universe. And if we think of our bones as being similar to a landscape, that can happen.
Mm.
I love doing emerging plants pushing out of the ground buds opening, leaves opening, that moment. And it's good for me, when I remember to do it, to pay attention to each moment. I'm thinking that I do a lot of bird nests. Don't know, can't explain it all. But those are all the things that show up in my work. As I say, as I'm working, I'm looking for beautiful, earthy stuff, and it feels like a meditation to me. I was struck looking through the Birchfield Penny website that Bruce Bidmead refers to his work as being like a prayer. And, you know, I know, love, and admire Bruce, and I understand what he's saying, I think.
The way you talk about your art and the way you talk about the elevated nature that nature can take in your work, that the way you celebrate some very small parts of nature, you know, glorifies them, perhaps behind their size. And what's making me think about this is last spring, Scott and Tullis and I went on a trip to Salem, Ohio, which is where Charles Birchfield was born. And right. So we went there for the Homestead Society was having a party and that sort of thing. And so we went to represent the Birchfield. And Nancy came too, but she came separately. And so using the archives, we found some sketches that Charlie did of Salem, Ohio, where he used to go wandering in the woods and painting. And so we were able to take this map and overlay it on Google Maps and figure out about where we needed to go. And at one point, we just went for a hike in the woods, the same woods that Charlie used to, very young Charles Birchfield used to go and sketch in. And so for me, especially when I look at some of his paintings, he celebrates spring flowers to this just massive proportion. You know, they're just like taking a trillium and hepaticas just take over the paintings. But when you see them in nature, you know, like bloodroot and these things, they're these incredibly small, tender flowers where they're preserving so much of their energy because they're such early spring flowers. But then you see the way he represents them, and it's just like this over-the-top, you know, chorus trumpeting to these flowers. And so, I don't know, I guess that really struck me that, like, in real life they're so tiny, but in how he felt them, it was so much bigger than that.
Heather, that's great. And I can see and I like that you use the word celebration. And they are tiny, but the energy, it's, well, actually, I got my artist statement here. And of course, one works on this. You try to say what you can to encapsulate what you do. Mm-hmm. So let me just read this because please. I'm pleased with it. Used it for years. The natural world is my source / magnet / metaphor. I draw and paint objects and events in nature, planets suspended, seeds opening, leaves unfurling, roots extending, for their inherent power and beauty and lyricism. At the same time, I draw into them human experience and concerns, things that have no material form, joy, serenity, anger, sorrow, loneliness, resolve, courage. Expressing paradox, seeking an equilibrium, is always a theme. I try to move past the surface to get to the internal energies to convey the power and mystery of the natural world, ourselves included. And that's what I hope I have in common with Charles Birchfield. Yeah. And that's what he has just accomplished so amazingly well.
Yeah.
Take those tiny things and captures all that energy.
Thank you,
Charles.
I feel like we kind of touched on the next question I generally ask, which is about the totality of your body of work and different themes that have emerged in mm-hmm. your production over the years. This has been a lovely time for me today because, you know, even before you talk about the different themes in your work, you've already showed me a tour of your house. And so I've seen some of the different themes that have emerged in your work, seen some of your paintings from a past life, as you said, and your enamel works, which I find really spectacular, as well as some publications that you've been featured in. And some of your works on handmade paper, that sort of thing. And so I've seen some of that today, but is there anything else you'd like to say about?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, Heather. The handmade paper, I don't see a difference between materials and my bringing an image out of them. So the paper I use has always been important to me. I've always leaned toward, you know, originally nice Italian papers or something, but in more recent years, I've had access to some beautiful Asian stuff that gets more and more irregular edges. And most recently, down at Western New York Book Arts Center, another great local resource, you can pick up handmade paper that people have done in workshops there. And it's some of it's really wacky with big, you know, holes intruding into it. And so my most recent work has been on that kind of paper, and it's not flat. So once you frame it, it has to be floated. And I love the idea of floating a drawing, not pinning it down with a mat, but just letting it float inside that frame and seeing a little shadow behind it. So when I start a work, I'll often wander around my home and my studio, and I have all kinds of things around that might strike me, whether it's an unusual stone, a piece of dried grass, a dead insect. But I might also open my flat files and find a piece of paper that somehow just speaks to me. And this has happened with a very recent piece where I went, oh, I have that old book cover that a friend gave me years ago. That would look good on this. And the book cover is from Tennyson Poetry. So I went to my bookshelf, bless my husband for collecting all these books, and there's a whole book of Tennyson Poetry, and it opened up to the page of a violet growing in the crack of a sidewalk. I knew in one of my sketchbooks from years ago, I had done a drawing, a study of a violet growing right down here outside my home in the sidewalk. And it's always amazing to me that nature can do this out of the concrete. And so the piece ended up being a photocopy from my sketchbook and the book cover and a photocopy of the poem by Tennyson, all mounted on some wonderful Asian papers. And when I photocopied, it didn't work so well the first time. I went and looked back in my flat file, and once Catherine Parker gave me a bunch of offcuts from her wonderful watercolors. Mm-hmm. So I had small pieces, and I tried them in my printer, and lo and behold, I was able to print the poem from Tennyson on a piece of paper that Catherine Parker had given me. Connections, connections, connections.
Again, that's what I call
it. So that's how the process can work for me. And the other thing is, this is important, I realize I'm very much into adding, subtracting, and dark and light. I've always loved chiaroscuro. Mm-hmm. And so all my work will have dark areas and light areas, and the light areas will often just open into that Zen endless light. But for me, somehow, you don't have light without the darkness. It's always that paradox. So when I'm working, I tend to work primarily with pastel, not a lot of bright color, but some, charcoal, but I'll put some down, and then I use my eraser as much as I use the tool. So I'm reminded of Michelangelo saying that he cuts into a block of marble and finds the body inside. And I feel exactly like that. I have a piece of paper. I begin to add charcoal, graphite, then I take some off, and I'm finding the drawing that's in the paper. That's how I work, Heather. That was a good question.
Thank you for taking the time to really be thoughtful and answer that.
Well, my pleasure, truly. A few years ago, not that many, I ran across something called scholar's stones. It's been a tradition for hundreds of years among Asian scholars to be out walking and note a particular stone. There may be many stones on your path, but somehow one strikes the person and pick it up and you see things in it. My son's girlfriend gave me a wonderful book called Scholar's Stones, and in there is a poem. It's probably a couple hundred years old, and I'm paraphrasing now, but the thoughtful person who was walking along picked up a stone, looked at it, and said, "I see the Eastern Sea, and I slip the Eastern Sea into my sleeve." And I love that something as large as a whole seashore can go into your sleeve of your kimono. What else we got here?
I feel like, so the next question I often ask is talking about your creative process. But I feel like you have touched on that in many ways.
I think we have covered that.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I see here that on occasion I try to, again, capture more of nature, not just how it looks, but the feeling of sun or wind or water current. I know that the piece in the Birchfield Penny collection is a stone underwater, and I think I managed to grab hold of that movement. Again, you remember being a kid underwater and looking at the way grasses float by. You had a good question. What do you hope to achieve with your art? I liked thinking about that. It's like a language to me, a way to finally convey something to my fellow humans that I can't do in words.
That's interesting, because as your aunt told you, you have very good use of language, and yet even that wasn't enough.
You know, Heather, that's right, and that's, you know, some of this stuff I've thought about for years, and other things just came to the surface in the last few days as you offered me this process. But I guess for the viewer, I mean, when I'm working, I'm honestly doing it because it's just something that feels good to me. As I say, a kind of meditative process. And it's fun. It's just downright fun to mess with the materials. But for the viewer, I do hope that now, if someone sees it, or someone who doesn't exist yet in the future, that my work might facilitate that pause. Just help someone to be present, something that stops them, something that calls them to return, to find more reflections of their own soul, their own path, their own journey. And it has actually even happened for me that people have seen something and put it into some words and shown me something in my work that I didn't even know was there. And that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that sort of, and I see that as the seed. You know, your work is a seed that grows into something that you can't predict what it is, because at a certain point, it's beyond just you. You know, it's when somebody else is inspired by what you do, or when somebody else, you know, I think about this a lot with literary criticism, where you know, somebody says to an author, oh, well, what about these themes in your work? And the author's like, I didn't include those themes in my work. And it's like, well, okay, but you know, we see some of these themes in your work.
Yeah.
You know, it might not have been intentional, but we're finding things that perhaps you didn't see. And I see that with art as well. You know, I mean, you know, literature is a form of art, but that what you make at a certain point becomes a part of an organic process for something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it feels like an end point, but really, you just can't see where the path is continuing now.
I think it happens both ways. I've also had the occasion where somebody saw something and I said, no, that's not there.
Yeah.
But they're doing something for themselves.
But it is for them, right.
Yeah. Here's one last one. I notice I've always come back to drawing. As I mentioned earlier, I was an enamelist for a few years. I've done sculpture, I've done painting. But I always come back to drawing. And for the past few years, that's all I've been doing, just drawing. And I was wondering why. That's interesting to me. And I'm thinking, thanks to this interview, that it's a way to touch or connect with the subject. I suspect this is what I'm doing. Back in college, when Morton Grossman was teaching us contour drawing, I loved that you're following the edge of an object with your pencil. Don't look at your paper. Just do it. I was fascinated. And I see that as a constant in my work. My work now, still, I love that edge line. But over the years, I've come to need to always break it, always leave it open so that the larger universe can enter. And equally, the chiaroscuro, the dark and light, I love that back in my undergraduate days. I remember, and I don't remember which instructor it was, but we were to draw the model. We had a nude model without making any lines. We could only draw spaces. And so where the spaces went in, make them dark, and where they came forward, make them light. That was a little unsettling at first, but looking over my work over all the years, I always need that dark and light, and I need to accept that things have to go off into the darkness, and conversely, I need to accept that some things need to go off into the blazing light. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's my final thoughts. Why do I like drawing? The only way to have one of those things, the dark or light, is to have the other. That paradox is essential to my work. I do beautiful things, and there's some wonderful artwork that's not beautiful at all. It's very ugly, and I appreciate and love it. But for me, I guess I just hook up with beautiful things. But it can't just be form and no meaning, no content, or vice versa. It can't just be content, something conceptual, with no interesting or enthralling form. So for me, I need beautiful or interesting form, but also content. Not just enthralling content, but also engaging form. So that's all a little repetitive, but that's what it is. And then the final thing, I was talking to my pal Gary just the other day about how we know when something is done. He's working hard on his current show. And I say, well, I just listen to them sing. And he paused and he said, oh, aha. That's truly how I do it. I go in, you know, I've worked on a drawing for a few days, and I go back, and sometimes it's not singing yet, so I have to do something more. And then other times, you go in, and it's finally singing, and I go, okay, it's done.
Well, given that Gary's upcoming show is paintings of street musicians, I feel like that's a very appropriate sort of a metaphor for him. One of the questions I ask, I often try to think about who's listening to these interviews, you know, and I imagine young emerging artists having an opportunity to hear so many different perspectives through these interviews. And so part of what I want to ask you is, what are some things you have done to personally advance your career in the arts? And we kind of talked about how, and she's laughing right now, and, you know, life is such a part of art, but what are some of the few hoops that you've managed to jump through?
Yes, I am laughing because I remember making a note of this. Oh, yeah, one of the questions you listed, what have you done personally to advance your career in the arts? And I wrote down, not a whole lot, exclamation point. I seem to be missing that chip in my DNA. I do regularly enter juried shows. I do enjoy knowing and learning from other artists. I've won some prizes, had a good deal of work purchased, love imagining it hanging all over Western New York and a bit beyond. And then, as I mentioned earlier, work acquired by Roswell Park, Children's Hospital, one in the Birchfield, etc. But I haven't done a lot. I did get an SOS grant once. I'm just not consistent, not great at follow-up. So what would an inconsistent person like me recommend to emerging artists? Well, here's my notes. Look for your own path. There are some people who really are suited to forging ahead in the art world as it is constructed and getting well-known, and getting some major monetary rewards. Oh my gosh, another favorite artist of mine I forgot to mention was Anselm Kiefer. Mm. I mean, very successful monetarily.
Not necessarily happy.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know how that came to be, but he certainly did things his own way. So my advice for emerging artists, look for your own path. Learn to recognize what's right for you, but always be open to learning from others, including three-year-olds.
Priscilla, this has been such a wonderful morning here at your house, hanging out and just talking about your art, about, you know, your impact on this community. And thank you so much for this time.
Well, back at you, kid, and you are welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome. You're the best. Yeah. So this is another interview of the Living Legacy Project, normally at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, but today at Priscilla Bowen's house.